We will get it done, and the energy of these young people just tells me that we are going to get it done. Laura here is just another piece of evidence that we are going to be fine as a people. So who's representing you guys?
I think your hand is going to go first. I'm going to talk briefly and then...
All right, come behind the podium here. Not the mic here. So they will continue to introduce each other and share with you guys for the amount of time we've given them. Let me start you off with Chancey Fleet.
We are children of the future. Wonder where this world is going to. Going to.
Oh, boy. I'd like to start by congratulating our new NIAB's president, Nihal Erkan. I'm serving as vice, and Valeria Paradiso is serving as secretary. Our new board members, both of whom are blasts from the past, for those of you who have been around for a little while. Jim Gashel and Mark Maurer. Tommy Needham and Noria Nodran. I want to talk a little bit about what the student division is here to do. Hope to be brief. The better to let Shafika take the reins here. During his remarks on signing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Lyndon Baines Johnson observed that those who founded our country knew that freedom would be secure only if each generation fought to renew and enlarge its meaning. For nearly 75 years, the leaders and members of the National Federation of the Blind have provided blind Americans with the tools each of us needs to pursue our own freedoms, to engage with the world, to apply our full energy and passion to higher education, to work at jobs and avocations that fit our minds and bodies well, and to know and use our strengths so that we can live our lives with dignity, independence, and joy. As a student division, it's our job to find blind students and new professionals and acquaint them with the knowledge that each of them has the power to renew and enlarge the freedoms of choice, of expression, of action in their lives. Sometimes we find people who are at a place in their lives where the idea is abstract at best, or scary, and at worst unattainable. We find people sitting passively in classes while a sighted person deputized by disability services is taking notes for them. We find people who are afraid to go to college at all, or who have begun distancing themselves from their truest career aspirations because they've heard that teaching or science or theater or whatever it is would be just too difficult for a blind person to accomplish. We find blind people who are mourning the loss of reading or traveling solo or art now that they are blind. It's our job to bring these people into a state of hope, expectation, and readiness to take on the challenges of the kind of lives that they actually want. We do that by being brave enough ourselves to try new things and by sharing and teaching what we know. We do it by sharing our deep acquaintance with the membership of the NFB and with the achievements of blind students and professionals in every field around the world. And we do it through ongoing, vigorous, broad-based dissemination of the techniques that these blind students and professionals are using through seminars, publications, social media, and one-to-one discussion. Ani DeFranco says that every tool is a weapon if you use it right. Every new connection that we are able to forge between a blind student or new professional looking for answers and a competent blind student or professional with answers is a weapon that we can use to diffuse complacency, learned helplessness, and despair. In the student division, we endeavor to remember that we can all lead and be led. In September, Shafika, who you're about to hear from, and who is our New Jersey Association of Blind Students president, spearheaded a phenomenal 3-day retreat to educate us about the subminimum wage issue. Even the most experienced activists on our team were able to learn something at that event from our national leadership, including Anil Lewis, and attendees of the event who have disabilities other than blindness, because Shafika made sure to include people from other parts of the disability movement. Even the newest people on our team brought their expertise on everything from winning support from other organizations on campus to perfecting social media strategy. That happened in August. And I think it kind of tweaked New York a little bit into thinking that perhaps we should do something also. So in September, our student division held a teach-in hosted by the Haskell Library, you just heard from Caroline, on advocacy, collaboration, and technology. There was no single coordinator of this event. About a dozen people worked together to create an agenda which included speakers on higher ed law, legislative strategy, rehab, literacy, open source technology, social media for activism, the fair wage movement, library resources, cross-city agencies, scholarships and resources available through the NFB. Our event was launched with the help of a brand new website, which was created by our team members, social media, a word of mouth campaign. We did not use any outside agencies to help us with our mailings. Literature on Newsline, Bookshare, and the array of agencies serving the blind in New York was curated. We got audio of the event that's going to go up on our website. And we created a space that was inviting, we hope, and collaborative. We served refreshments. We went for about 6 hours, and we had representatives from our scholarship program, Kate, and Ray Wayne was the liaison from our broader New York affiliate. We had 25 attendees there for a packed six-hour agenda, and many of them came to us for dinner afterwards. Many of those folks are now coming to our chapter meetings. A lot of them are talking to us online and corresponding, and I know of at least one individual that I saw for the first time there who's here today. Does anyone want to guess how long that planning took?
4 weeks.
How long?
4 weeks.
I guess 4 weeks. Anybody else? Oh, shy group or post-lunch group? So from the first word on planning to execution, we did it in 3 weeks. We believe that blind people can do rocket science, but this is not rocket science. And so what I want to leave you with is the message that there's a job for everyone, there's a leadership role for everyone, and there's help for everyone, and that whether you're a student or a new professional or someone that is interested in working with us to help students and new professionals get their feet and stay on their feet and aspire to do more, we have a place for you, and we look forward to collaborating with just about everyone here. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Shafiqa Hashash. I'm a junior at NYU, and I'm a double major in politics and Middle East Islamic studies. So besides, you know, one of my main passions, which is Middle East studies, my other passion is disability studies. And this summer, starting the semester before this summer, I had the position of coordinating a seminar for students with disabilities, and that, you know, everything from funds, speakers, a venue, advertising, like all those details. But, you know, it was a lot of time, and it's very doable. And I think my goal for this talk particularly is to kind of invigorate people and show people how doable it really is, and to have everybody else to be able to create these types of seminars and campaigns. So the goal of the seminar was not only to learn about the subminimum wage issue, but to then go back to their campuses or regions and create these really strategic campaigns that would teach about wage discrimination. And, of course, you know, we did this on the Boycott Goodwill campaign. That's NFB's, you know, big campaign for the past couple of years. And I think, you know, when people really learn about it, you see how amazing of a thing it really is and how it should be so important for us to really get behind it and do something really big for it and push it forward. So something that I kind of learned at the last talk I gave, which was about an hour ago, at the student division meeting, and sorry if this is a little bit repetitive for people who were there for that, was that some people are really misinformed or have a lack of information regarding the campaign itself or regarding, you know, really how to take criticism and then respond to it and how to work on rebuttals. So I am going to just go over some subminimum wage things. And again, I'm sorry for, you know, experts, but I feel like it's really hard to become as familiar with it as Anil, Mark, or Kobono, anyone, and to really feel like you can have that power to have as much knowledge as they do on the topic. So one of the main things is, of course, Section 14C, which was created in 1938 after the Great Depression, and it was created to help people with disabilities. And, you know, you have Jim Gibbons, who says that these jobs of subminimum wages are not about livelihood, but about fulfillment. And we're going to come back to the interesting words he's portrayed. And you have 400,000 workers, about 400,000, who work under Section 14C. 95% of them work in sheltered workshops. 51% of them make less than $2.50 an hour. So you have 200,000 people in this country who legally make less than $2.50. Anyone in the city, your metro fare an hour. And of them, only 5%, so 10,000, 12,000, ever leave these types of jobs. You have Goodwill that's employing 109 of these sheltered workshops with 7,200 people in them. And the pay for the executives of these 109 workshops is $57.8 million. So each of them is raking in about $500,000, more or less. South California has about $1.1 million for their CEO, et cetera, et cetera. So under Section 14C, you have the premises of it's very difficult for the disabled to find work. They do less than their non-disabled counterparts, and it's there to create employment for them. Under sheltered workshops, you have jobs that have no skill to them. And I really, truly mean that. I mean things like capping pens, putting tape on something, folding it, very, very little skill. And you have the belief that some people just don't have a capacity to do skilled work. And, you know, they call the subminimum wage work, like, meaningful, but there's no competition for it. It's not meaningful enough to get $7.25, which isn't even a great minimum wage, you know, for anyone who's kept up with inflation or any of those numbers. It's not a real wage. That's still a ridiculous wage, too. But so it's meaningful enough that there's no competition, there's no floor for there to have a wage, and there's no non-disabled people performing this task, so I really need to find the meaning behind these jobs. They believe that work isn't about pay, but the experience, and that's just such a terrible bar to be setting for people. It's the concept of inequality that at least these disabled people get out of the house. What kind of bar is that to be setting? Because that's not, you know, the lowest point and then we'll work up from there. That's the high point. The high point is at least they got out of the house today. And, you know, to get these payments, and I'm just going to go into this a little bit, they do these things called time trials, where you go up to a person with multiple disabilities and you say, this time trial is going to determine what you're going to be making for the next year. And, you know, can anyone imagine that, like, working under pressure, under that? And they take them and they have to compare it to the job closest to it. So if you are a pen capper, what is the closest job to being a pen capper that you can compare a wage to? The answer is nothing. There's no close job to being a pen capper. And we have to understand, you know, one other really big thing is that this isn't a capitalistic organization. They're not a business that's, you know, trying to cut costs as much as they can. You know, of course they are a little bit. But their operational model is as a charity. And that's something we have to remember so much, is they are a, quote, charity, quote. So when they employ these people with disabilities, they get these huge million-dollar contracts from the government. So a lot of people are saying, why Goodwill, though? There's 400,000 people, 200,000 make less than $2.50 an hour. Goodwill only employs 7,200 people under sheltered workshops. Not a humongous chunk. But Goodwill, first and foremost, prides itself on their disability employment. They have several wages under a dollar. The issue was brought to them, and they created lobbying teams. So you can't pay people minimum wage, but you can pay people to lobby to not pay people minimum wage. Yeah. You know, They're a household name, and again, they receive huge lucrative contracts. But another thing with Goodwill, which I don't know if this was intentional, but it ends up working in our favor, is that a lot of universities team with them. So NYU, which is, again, where I go to school, at the end of each school year, gives 40 tons to Goodwill, and that's everything from printers to clothing to, you know, brand new mirrors and dressers and anything students buy who don't live in the, you know, East Coast area that they don't take home with them. They are, again, a $5 billion a year grossing charity. So this isn't Goodwill. This is really good business, not Goodwill. But so our seminar had three, you know, focus areas to it. We first held discussions on philosophy and really understanding what people created the idea of disability and, you know, what people created the idea of this niche group of people are not worthy enough to be paid this menial, small minimum wage. Bless you. We then had everyone research their universities and, you know, we tried to split up into regional groups and research what ties they had with Goodwill and with, you know, other organizations that practice subminimum wages. We then made, you know, these power maps, And power maps are something that are really, really great. And they outline the groups that are collaborating with you or could potentially collaborate with you. And it really makes you feel like it's not this giant project and you and the two other disabled people in your college are the ones who are working on it. But you have labor groups in your college. You have the human rights groups. You have Amnesty International. You have whatever you want to team up with in that university to get behind this campaign. And it's not just you, and you're not alone, and you can have a great team of people to do it. And we had, you know, Hasseline activities, which are you have one person promoting, you know, what the NFP is promoting, and you have another person promoting what Goodwill is doing and subminimum wages. And it teaches you to think under pressure. And when you're doing protests and when you're handing out flyers, people will ask you questions, and you should be prepared to answer these questions. But it's a lot easier to sit in a conference room and say these really well-thought-out, articulate, educated responses than when someone is saying something to you on the street and it's a stranger, a person who truly believes what they're saying. They're not just saying it to make millions. They're just a regular person. And, you know, to kind of think critically and respond to them. And so we had these really great actions, and each group created small, realistic actions and then large-scale actions, which is, you know, removing universities and or regions from their involvement. And the small-scale actions were things that anyone can do, anyone from, you know, middle school to, I don't want to say old people, but to old people. But, to senior citizens. But, you know, things like circulating a petition made for the younger people or the really techie, not younger people, Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, small things, but the ultimate goal and having this ultimate goal in mind of removing ties. And we had these really awesome slogans that were made that I really do want to share, and they're things like 1930s wages don't pay our 2013 bills. Goodwill, bad wages, greedwill, pocket change doesn't equal pay. And I have to say, I learned so much from this seminar and from creating it. And I'm not just saying, you know, I learned obviously so much from Anil Lewis, who was our speaker. I learned a lot from, his name is Pete Ruh, and he works for The Nation, if people know. That's a really big magazine. But he talked a lot about labor rallies and strikes that were happening and how they could team up with them, because these are mass rallies that are happening nationally and having big shutdowns, and they're phenomenal. But I learned to challenge my own misconceptions about disability capabilities, because I will be very honest and say that if you asked me 3 years ago, what could a deaf, blind woman with autism do as a career making minimum wage, I would not have been able to tell you. I would have no answer for you, and that would be that. And I don't know that I would have gone so far to say she deserves sub-minimum wages, but I wouldn't have known to respond to you. But it turns out there's thousands of people who have disabilities like deaf, blind, with autism, or, you know, cerebral palsy and something else or whatever, and they're doing meaningful work across the globe. And they're performing actual monetary and mentally fulfilling work. I learned to understand that, you know, people with disabilities are fearful of losing these jobs, and that you have to really understand that they've been put in this situation of extreme vulnerability, and you can't blame them for that. You know, it's not their fault. It's the system that created this. And you have to understand that people in these jobs and their families or whatever have never exposed them to anything better. If everyone has been setting the bar your entire life at zero, what are you going to accomplish? If your mom and your dad and your rehab worker and everyone who quote-unquote loves you has put your bar at ground level, what are you going to do? And I think, you know, something that was a really eye-opening scenario was if everyone can think of the first time someone told them, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I think for me it was probably at like 5 in kindergarten. You do those little projects. Then again, every year until you graduate college, basically, what are you going to do with that degree? What are you going to do as a liberal arts student? What are you going to do? No one ever asks us to the STEM students, by the way, but, you know, they'll have jobs. But, you know, you're asked this several times throughout your life, but these people who are put into subminimum wage jobs, they're asked this for the first time when they're 18 or 21, and it's just a little laundry list of options. And, you know, it's so easy to be put into these subminimum wage work environments that that's what's done. And I learned that short-term consequences are necessary for long-term equality. Again, I'm sorry for people who heard this talk in the student division, because this is the part that's pretty repetitive. But, you know, you have the examples of slavery. You have the examples of, you know, just any problem you've faced in the past, when it's ended, so when slavery ended, there were masses afraid of, you know, what was going to happen. Because while slavery was horrific, this was the roof over my head and the, you know, subpar meal that it was a meal. It was something. And something is better than absolutely nothing. But would you argue that because something is better than absolutely nothing, we should have kept slavery in place? No, you hopefully, to God, would never argue that. I learned about charitable organizations and their means of profit, and that it really is a myth that these people are going to lose, or at least the majority will lose their jobs. Because you have to understand that if they lose their jobs, they lose the group's goodwill, loses their federal contracts. They're not profiting off of Mr. and Mrs. Pencapper. They're profiting off of keeping Mr. and Mrs. Pencapper in place, and then the government giving them money. So I learned that there are good systems in place, like Walgreens, and there are idealized systems and, you know, community-based settings where you're not throwing the 100 disabled people who live in Arkansas into this workshop, but you're actually integrating them into community settings and into jobs where it's not just them and people with disabilities, and you're totally segregating them away from society. And I think something really big is that, yeah, while sub-minimum wages perpetuate inequality, the notion that there are people who are less capable and there are people who, you know, deserve less or, you know, just should be pitied is what lets subminimum wages exist in the first place and what lets them keep existing. And I think, you know, I'm not trying to get cheesy, but as you know, as a college student, I stopped doing so much NFB stuff, but it really kind of came back to me how much the motto and how much, you know, everything that NFB says is so true and that it's about opportunities. And, you know, with opportunities and training, disability can be reduced to no more than a physical nuisance. And this seminar was just a launching pad. So while it's a lot of work, we taught, we're done. It's a launching pad for kids to go back to their schools, to go back to Cornell, NYU, University of Texas, where their NFB actually sponsored a student to come out to the seminar, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, like CUNY, just like phenomenal schools, where they went back and are integrating campaigns. And I just like to say that the 17th is a day of action. And because it's so recent, you know, it isn't the huge day of action. That'll be later in the year. But it's a day of action at least to inform people of what's going on. And we have a Facebook, and it's facebook.com/goodwillbadwages. And, you know, just long-term plans are really set in place. And the seminar attendees have been doing, like, such great work. And we have a working group that keeps in touch with everyone and how important it is to make this a cross-disability movement. You know, we have to be very honest and say that the subminimum wage issue is not just a blind issue. If anything, it's more of another disability issue than a blind issue. And how important it is to team up with groups like the Autism Self-Advocacy Network, which is similar motto of NFB, of people with autism speaking on their behalves. And, you know, I really want to drive this notion home that it's so important to get involved. And it's so important not to think that you don't have to wait until you're at a Neil Lewis status or Mark Riccobono status to start doing something, or until then, you know, you aren't important enough to do it. But it's the local scale chapters and the local divisions that are so important. And without them, you wouldn't have an NFB altogether. And so if everyone participates fully, then, you know, this is what really launches a campaign. And that there is a better future available. And I'm not talking about a lofty future. You know, I'm talking about a future that is foreseeable and within the coming years. Thank you.
Do we have a good future ahead of us or what? Ladies, on behalf of this generation, I thank you for reminding me there was a 60s. What goes around comes around, and I'm glad it's come around again.
Your prize time.
Okay, get him ready. It's that attitude that is eventually going to win the day on minimum wage and justice and all the other things, all the other buzzwords, with justice for all. I hear that someplace all the time. I said it this morning. We're going to get justice for all eventually.